Good morning, everyone. It is good to see you. I usually open up with something sort of humorous and just sort of get people sort of lightened up to listen, and I don't really think I need to do that today. It has already been done. But that was fun, and this is an exciting part of the year for us, so we appreciate you watching and hopefully got a good laugh out of it. What I will say is that we have been going through this series on idolatry. We said idolatry is one of those key sins of the Old Testament. It's what Israel gets accused of doing over and over again. And as such, it's sort of odd that we don't always talk about it today. And we tried to talk about what would be the modern equivalent of idolatry. And we spent our first week just sort of trying to define it and understand what it is. And what we ultimately landed on was giving undue attention, worship, or devotion to any aspect of creation rather than creator. In other words, we switch out the God who created the universe with some aspect of what he created instead. And when we worship the things that are created rather than were created at all, we often somehow miss the boat, and we ultimately become elevated to our own God. Our selfishness gets put at the top of that altar, and the world becomes our ultimate goal. In the second week, we try to sort of isolate different categories and things that we might turn into idols. So the second week, we talked about the things that we create in our lives and how we spend our life building something, building a family or a career or possessions or something that we can sort of carve out our niche in the world, and how that little thing that we've created can become something that we will hold on to the point of sinning in order to maintain it and being less open to the call of God to go wherever he might call us. And then last week we switched from the things we created to the groups we belong to, and how we have this tendency to align ourselves with something bigger than us. And then sometimes, occasionally, that thing bigger than us, the category we fall into, becomes more important than the God we worship, because we start defending that to the loss of everything else. And so today we want to move into one more category. And we'll try to kind of wrap up this series today. And the thing that I failed to mention early on, and honestly, maybe I should have, but I think it's really strange when we realize that the New Testament itself actually gives us a modern equivalent of idolatry. Not once, but twice. And today I want to kind of venture into that and go a little bit further in that. So, we actually have two Bible verses today. One is out of Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. And in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, we get this important pronouncement from the Apostle Paul in a letter to the church at Colossae. And he says this, and it's very interesting when we think about what modern day idolatry is. He says it like this: "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is what? Idolatry. Greed, which is idolatry." Okay, now keep that in mind and flip over to Ephesians chapter 5. There are a lot of parallels between Ephesians and Colossians, almost down to the very structure of the books. But go to Ephesians chapter 5, also verse 5, and hear this one: "For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such is a what? Can you say idolater? Idolater. Has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." Okay, so twice now, the New Testament gives us a modern equivalent of idolatry. And in both cases, it's the same thing. One talks of greed, and the other talks of a greedy person. Basically, the same idea, right? And so, greed is, at least according to Paul, one of the equivalents of idolatry in our modern world. Greed, the need to have more than other people, to want everything and everything that you can have around you. Greed to be competitive and want to amass more than you actually need. Greed and all of those things can become an idol. It's close to the idea of materialism, but I think it's a bit more. Now, if you've been at our church for a while, you know that usually when I read you a translation, I usually read out of the New International Version, the NIV. It's not because I think it's better than all the others, it's just one I happen to think is solid and it generally works for us. However, in this rare case, I'm going to argue that I actually prefer a different one. So whereas the NIV uses greed and greedy person, what's funny is if you go through kind of an informal list of all the different translations, and I encourage you to do this sometimes when you read a passage to compare how different translations translate it, about half of them come up with greed or greedy person, and the other half, anyone know? Covetousness or coveting person. And I find this interesting because to me they have slightly different thoughts and tones to them. Greed versus coveting. And I think this is important. I actually made a little chart. This is such a official looking chart. You like it? This is just me sort of comparing things in my mind. A little bit different emphasis and experience with it, right? So when I think of greed, I think of it being primarily about materialism, right? I want more money. I want more possessions. I want the better car. I want the bigger house. And it's easy for me to sort of categorize greed in that sense. And that also makes it easier for me to let go of it because I don't think of myself as particularly materialistic. Particularly, I should say. I think of greed in terms of wanting more than others. That, well, they've got this, so I'm going to outdo them with more. I think of greed as inherently competitive. I've got to have the most. They say the only thing a greedy person will really be happy with is not more than they could ever live with, but more than the person next to them. It's greed. It's competitive. And lastly, I think of greed as being sort of arrogant. You know, I'm above the fray. I deserve more than other people and that kind of thing. But the reason I want to call attention to this other translation of covetousness or coveting person is because one, thou shalt not covet, actually made the top 10 sins of all time, right? Like the 10 commandments, it got in there. And number two, I find it harder to dismiss for me personally, and maybe for you. Covetousness for me doesn't feel like materialism so much as life circumstances. I really wish my life circumstances were more like this other person who I'm a little bit jealous of and envy sometimes. Or covetousness doesn't feel like it wants more than others. It just wants to be normal. It just wants to be like everybody else, you know? They've all got this. Now, why don't I have this? It's concerned with fairness and equality. Why does everyone else seem to come so easy for them, but not for me? Speaking in relative terms, covetousness is meeker almost, smaller in spirit. And I mean that in the worst possible way. Like a small person who just is bitter about things, you know? It's different from the arrogant materialism of greed because it just wants to be like everyone else. And it's kind of bitter about the fact that it doesn't have what they perceive everyone else has. And I find that really important because I can dismiss greed when examining myself a lot more than I can dismiss the covetousness part. Because the covetousness part sounds a lot more familiar, at least for me. And I think that that's really important when we think about this idea of idolatry and the things of this world and getting caught up in the things of this world and switching out creation for creator. Just in my experience with my own self, as well as my experience as a minister, counseling people, talking to people about things going on in their lives. Here are just some of the things that I hear a lot. And I'm going to kind of throw these out rapid fire, and I'm hoping that as I talk about these, something will sort of stick and land and sound familiar to you as well, maybe. This is one, I'm going to be honest, this comes directly from Jen and I's conversations. I wish that my parents lived close enough to babysit. Seems like everyone else has that, you know. Their parents just take the baby for the weekend and they can go on a date. And it's just not that simple for us, you know. And it's a little harder to get away, and all of a sudden there's been something that needs to be done in the yard and it's been sitting there for a month and I can't get it done, you know. Sometimes I hear people say things like, I wish I had the relationship with my grandkids that they have with their grandkids, you know. They live close, they visit often, they get along, but my family's just more broken than that. I hear people say like, you know, I wish I had a job that I really loved, that I could sink my heart and soul into, that was a passion or a vocation, and I just don't have that. I'm just working for the paycheck, and these other people, they seem to love what they do, and I wish I had that, you know? I covet that. And none of these are particularly materialistic, right? That family, their kid is so smart or so athletic or so successful. I wish my kid did the things that their kid did. I'm sorry, I'm trying to speak the things we wouldn't say out loud too, you know? I wish that our family, just in general, looked as picture perfect as their family does. Every time they go on vacation and post a picture on Facebook, it's like they've got the perfect little family. Why doesn't my family look like that? These are all things I've collected from my own conversations with people. I wish everything came so easy to me, like it seems to come so easy to that person. Everything they do, it looks effortless and it always works out. And just that doesn't fit the mess of my life, you know? Why can't it be easy for me like it is for them? You know, that person they have so much talent, and I just wish I had any talent as much as the talent that they have for that one thing. But God didn't give me that. I wish, like, you know, this person over here, they can eat anything they want, and they still stay skinny all the time. I wish I could eat like that and not gain any weight. I wish I just wasn't so broken as a person. I could do more like everyone else. I wish I could have fun as easily as other people seem to have fun, laughing and smiling and going about life, and I just don't feel that way. I wish I had such a caring and beautiful spouse as this person has. I wish I had all the things that people my age are supposed to have by the time they get to my age. Feels like I'm behind, or I just never got it. And underlying all of those is perhaps this one statement. I wish I could be, and here's the word I use, normal. I wish I could be normal. That's the word, what I've heard all the time, right? I wish I could just be like everybody else, and I wish I could be normal. Because we all perceive ourselves as lacking what we think is normal all the time. And we measure up all the places where we didn't get what everyone else got. And this is the problem, right? Because normal is a problematic word. Because you can't define it, can you? You can morph it into whatever you think normal is. It has to do with the way you grew up. It's all a matter of perception. It's a conglomeration of every TV show you've ever seen, every movie you ever watched that made you expect certain things out of life. And it's all been sort of strung together haphazardly in your mind as what normal is. It changes with time and place. What's normal at one age is not normal at another age. What's normal in one part of the world is not normal in another part of the world. What's normal in one decade is not what's normal in another. It has to do with the things we see online, in particular social media, that tell us what normal looks like in our own day and age. And all in all, we come to the conclusion that somehow we are missing out on something, and covetousness and perhaps even bitterness takes hold. And what's really ironic about normal is that it's almost always never true. Just as much as you think that you are outside of the norm, statistically, you're probably not. I mean, so say you struggle with, you're in your 20s or maybe your 30s or maybe older and you're single. And then you look at it and you see like 98% of people get married at some point in life. I made that up, by the way. Don't look that up, okay? Point being that you're probably not as far outside the normal as you think. Beyond that, the normal you think of is just this thing that you put together in your mind. And by the way, all the people you think are happier than you and are getting along okay and more financially successful, you realize that's all based on the little bit that they show you, either on Facebook or in an hour on Sunday morning, or in the little bit of time you see them. And what you don't know is behind the scenes, they too are swimming in debt. They too are arguing at home at night. They too are dealing with some other issue with their kid who's getting in trouble with something. They too are dealing with all the things that you deal with. But you don't see that. You see that little sliver of what they want you to see about their life. Meaning that almost every case, normal is a lie. And it's a lie that has deceived you and put you into your own unhappiness. Coveting is maybe more dangerous than greed. If you're talking about the idols in our lives that choke out our ability to produce for God. Feeling the need to be normal and like other people is something that often causes us to make bad decisions in life. In fact, I can give you a Bible example before I even give you a bunch of earthly ones that I've seen in my life. For instance, if you go over to 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you've got your Bibles, I'd love for you to open it up. But go to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and you'll see a very relatable story. It happens when Israel is very early on. They've become a nation, they're in the promised land, and they've been led so far by judges who are kind of like rulers or kings, but are smaller, more provincial, and they sort of come and go more easily. And the bridge between those judges into the actual kings and the monarchy is one man by the name of Samuel, who operates as kind of the last of that era of the judges and then anoints the very first kings. He's sort of that bridge between the two eras. And Samuel, in particular, is kind of leading Israel at this time. And the Israelites come to Samuel, and they have a request, because they decide that it's time that they need to have a king. And this is how it goes. Chapter 8, verse 4. They say it like this. And I want you to pay attention to the wording. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "You are old," that's kind of rude, "and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us." And then what's that last phrase? "Such as all the other nations have." Such as all the other nations have. They all have kings. We don't have a king. We want you to appoint a king for us. Now, just so you know, Samuel, if you get more into the story, Samuel is upset by this because he realizes something that they don't, which is that the way it was designed is that God would be the king of Israel, that God would, in fact, be the one to reign. And so he does not like this, and he feels like it's a rejection, not just of him, but of God himself. And so Samuel goes to God in prayer and pleads with him that they have given this disrespect And they go back and forth in prayer. And finally, God essentially tells Samuel, listen, you need to warn them of all the things that are going to happen if they have a king. But in the end, if this is what they want, give them what they want. Which is also kind of scary too, right? That God will sometimes give you what you want. Believe it or not, that's a scary thing. Okay, now, go a little bit further, and Samuel comes and he gives them this speech and he talks about what a king will do. And he says, listen, you want a king like all the other nations, but let me tell you what that means. That means that all of your crops are going to be taxed. And a large portion of them are going to go to the king and not to you. You know what that means? It means your sons are going to be carried off into war. And you're going to lose them because they're going to go to defending and advancing the land by some king out there with his own ambitions. You know what this means. It means that your daughters are going to be taken away and married into some harem for the king and then traded like pawns to other kingdoms to create alliances with others. It says, you want a king. Let me just tell you what it's going to cost you. And as you can imagine, they say, oh, my bad. And then they move on, right? No. Jump down a little further. What verse? Verse 19. There we go. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. Then we will be like all the other nations. And that desire to be like everyone else around them, to feel legitimized as a true kingdom, to feel like they actually had power in the region, like they had reached some level of maturity, and to rush into that, having to have a king to be like everybody else. How did that work out? It was rough. Spoiler alert, read the rest of the Bible. But there are like 40 some bad kings and like 3 good ones. Point being that it ultimately led them toward idolatry, believe it or not. Led them toward mistakes, led their land to be raided, and ultimately to be overtaken by enemies. And so they look back at this moment, and you feel like the Israelites living in exile afterwards had to go back and read that passage and say, this is where we messed up. We made a mess of our lives in an effort to be like everybody else. That idol cost them God's true intent in their life. So what does like everyone else mean to you in your life? If you were trying to be like everyone else, what things are called to mind? For you, does it mean married? Does it mean owning your own home? Does it mean you have 2.5 kids and a labradoodle? Does it mean you got that white picket fence or that you work an 8-to-5 job with weekends off? Does it mean you're close to your family? Does it mean that on the weekend you take your boat to the lake? Does it mean you spend your Sunday mornings fishing and camping and hunting? And what I have to ask you is, where does the Bible call that normal or even good? Where does it require those things of your life in order to be righteous? Where does it say you have to be like everyone else? And I can tell you, in particular, if I could give you some examples of how this idol of wanting to be like others and coveting leads to very poor decisions and makes a mess of people's lives. As a Christian minister and a counselor, I've seen it over and over again, particularly the object of the problem of singleness, right? And I'll be honest, this hits home for me because, Jen and I, we actually met on eHarmony. We are a success story, all right? We were both out of school working as professionals when we first met. I just did marry before I was 30 by about this much. And I remember those struggles of being single in my 20s and wanting to have what everyone else seemed to have. And I can tell you, I didn't exactly live this out as well as I should have. I had my struggles with it. But I have seen what others have done with that singleness and the urgency and the need to get married and start their life, so to speak. That desire to be like everyone else. The bad decisions I've seen made. I have seen people in the name of getting married run through every red flag you could possibly imagine. Have you ever seen that? Someone who so desperately wanted to not be alone that they just dove into terrible relationships that were bad ideas. I don't need anyone to raise a hand. But you've seen this, no? I've seen people in the name of not being alone compromise the sexual morals that they believed they had because they didn't want to be alone. I've seen people isolate themselves from their families. I've seen people, I kid you not, fall victim to scams online because they so desperately wanted that relationship with that person to be real. I've seen people taken for all the money that they were worth. I had a lady at one of my old churches who got talked out of her, when the government was handing out all that money during COVID. What do you call those? Stimulus payments. Got scammed on all of her stimulus payment because she was trying to make some relationship online work because she didn't want to be alone. I've seen people get obsessed with things. I saw someone get a restraining order because they were so obsessed. I've seen people dive into marriages only to get divorced, and as soon as they were divorced, what did they do? Got right back into another dating relationship almost instantaneously because they couldn't stand being alone. I've seen people end up basically homeless and give up all their life savings. It is a terrible thing to lose everything you have in chase of the American dream and lose your relationship with God in the process. And this idol, dare I say, of being like everyone else has put many a life off track. And you could look back in your own exile and say, that's where we started wrong. That's where we wanted to be like all the other nations. That's where everything got messy. And I'm sorry, but I feel like this needs to be said. Because that's an idol. It's valuing something of creation rather than the Creator who made you. And you live your life for those purposes and you miss out on everything. Last I will say, you know, talk about running through red flags and maybe not marrying other Christians. Perfect example when Jen married me, you know. She always says that I lied on my application online because I said I was 5'5". I was 5'4 and a half, and 5'4 and a half was not an option, okay? Normal will ruin you if you insist on it even above God Himself. Normal is the opposite of gratitude. All that bitterness that can come from wanting to be like everyone else and that covetousness is the opposite of gratitude. One of the things that I've said this before, and whether you've heard it or not, I'm sorry, but we have a tendency, we always tell people, count your blessings. But what I find is that not only do we count our blessings, but we count the blessings of this person over here and this person over here, and then we compare ours to theirs and decide who came out on top. That's the opposite of gratitude. It's okay to count your blessings, but you ought to stop comparing them to everybody else. Gratitude is key on coming in on who you are and what you have and being happy and satisfied with that, at least for the moment. Comparison, as my wife has told me over and over again, is the thief of joy. It's a tool of Satan to convince you of a lie. The lie is you aren't enough as you are. That you must have something else to be whole or complete. More than that, it will point all your attention to the things of this earth so that nothing you can think about is beyond the realm of this planet. It's like in the parable of the soils, and you get that thorny soil and how the worries of this life and the cares and the deceitfulness of wealth choke out all the fruitfulness of that plant. You will be choked out of your usefulness to God if all you can think about are the things of this world and what you don't have. And you let that bitterness sink in. It is a thorn that will choke out your effectiveness and goodness in life. You stop looking upward at God and you start looking outward to see where you stand. You start complaining, this isn't fair. And you become bitter and small of spirit in all the worst ways. And finally, at the end of that, you turn inward and then you are truly lost. You have substituted the glory of God for the silly, temporary hopes of creation. You have committed idolatry. And according to the New Testament, that is the modern equivalent of the sin. To substitute creation for creator, covetousness even more than greed. Think of it again. It made the top 10 commandments. We should not want so desperately to be like others that we forget how much we need God. I'm try and give you a couple ways to apply this message. It's a hard one. It's a hard one for me too. And I'll give you a few. In fact, I doubled it up. Usually I only have one page of follow-up actions. I made two this week, all right? Because I need it. Number one, interrogate your idea of normal. In other words, aggressively interview it and figure out where that idea of normal came from. What is the source? Is it what you grew up with? Is it what you saw online? You might even find it was silly enough some episodes of Saved by the Bell when you were 13, okay? You will do some ridiculous things to assume what normal actually is. Interrogate it and come up with its final source so that you can let it go. Give up on fair. I know we say this, and this is something your mother said when you were also 13. Life isn't fair, right? But we all still hold on to the hope that we'll be as fair as possible. And unfortunately, I hate to say this, but we have to give up on fair. Fair is not going to make you happier. If anything, it will go the other direction. Number three, stop comparing your life to others. Stop counting their blessings before you count your own. Stop trying to figure out who's on top and who's doing the best, because that is the worst of humanity, to build our hierarchies and try to go up the ladder. Number four, and this is really key, stop assuming you know what other people's lives are actually like. I know you see them day to day and they always look put together, and every time you go over to their house, it's like clean as a whistle. I promise you their life is not always like that. Stop assuming you know what their life is actually like. Because behind all that wealth may be a lot of debt. And behind all of that happy smile might be a lot of arguments. And behind that clean home might be a home that's messy 98% of the time. You don't really know, because we all put on a facade. Going to the next page. Glorify God in whatever circumstance you have. That is your calling in life. Not saying you shouldn't improve your circumstance when you can. You should. But whatever circumstances you are in, you can glorify God in that place. Otherwise, He wouldn't have put you there. And even if you messed up and got there by accident, He can use it. So whatever circumstance you're in, glorify God with it. Number six, when you are lonely, lean into community. That's really hard when you're single or lonely or struggling in whatever way, or you don't have that relationship with your family or your grandkids. It's really, really hard. But one of the wrong things to do is then to isolate yourself from everyone and everything, and you only become lonelier. One of the reasons God called churches to exist was so that there would be communities of believers who could rely on each other and fill in that loneliness with substitute families. It's one of the beautiful things about church when we do it right. Lean into community. You have people who care about you, even if it doesn't look exactly like you wanted it to look like. Number 7, pray. And when you pray, tell God that He is enough for you. That you don't have to have everything that everyone else has. Because in the end, the only thing you truly need is Him. And you might not believe it at first, but pray that prayer over and over again till your heart starts to believe it. Remind yourself what it's really all about. And finally, and you know, honestly, you could end every sermon with this one. Fall in love with God's ways again. The number one commandment in the entire scripture is to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Fall in love with God again, and you will find your heart rehabilitated with joy. So where you can stop thinking about all the things around you and substitute that creation that you're worshiping for the creator of the universe. And then the thing you are worshiping will be big enough to fill you up, to take away all those things you think you don't have, and fill you with a peace, a fullness, and a joy, because He actually is enough. And when you fill yourself up on God, the emptiness you feel around you will be irrelevant, because He is all you actually need. Fall in love with the ways of God again, and the coveting will start to fade away. Idolatry is hard to define in the modern sense, but it is at least holding on to the things that we have built in our own lives before God. It's at least putting your group that you're a part of that gives you meaning above God. And it's at least wanting what everyone else has and living your life in misery because you don't have it. All those things make the grand mistake of substituting creation for creator. And you ultimately end up just as lost as the Israelites in the New Testament, wanting to be like everyone else. But God wants so much more for you than that. And it's time to claim that greater thing and let go of the thing you thought you were missing. If you will, bow your heads in prayer. God, I thank You for these hard lessons. I pray, God, that You will work even on me. I pray that I don't come across as if I've got all this figured out, because I do not. I pray, Lord, that where I have tried to scatter some seed of Your gospel, that You will then make those things grow in people's hearts and minds, that Your Holy Spirit will be present in revealing to them the things You want to talk about with them. I pray that in the end we don't feel beat up by these messages, but encouraged, because of the grace of God outlasts every sin and overcomes everything in our lives. That we actually don't need to do more, but need to do less. And instead, fill up a relationship with You that is at the heart of everything. I pray, God, that we know and feel Your love, Your grace, and Your forgiveness, that we might be free to pursue You and only You in this world around us. God, You are everything. You are enough. And You are our deepest desire. Thank You for making a way. And it's in Your Son's name we pray. Amen.